Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
That justice system ultimately ignored all of those bodies and all of the families.
The stories they don't want told.
I was one of many people that were victims who was used.
Being lied to, tricked, and traded like a commodity.
Holding the powerful to account.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. We're talking viruses for much of this edition, the ones that may yet pose a threat to us, the way we best share knowledge to be better prepared the next time one does, and progress towards an mRNA vaccine against the Mpox currently threatening Africa. But we're also taking time to listen in to the pairing rituals of birds the way a chick would, unhatched. From inside the egg. We start with another look at the constant threat of viral spillovers, zoonoses, from other animals. This time, the animals that are bred and farmed for their fur. We've talked anecdotally about the threat here, about the mink farmed in Spain and Finland that became infected with the worrying H5N1 strain of bird flu. They've been vaccinating farm workers in Finland to protect them from infection. And in 2020, SARS-2 coronavirus got into mink in Denmark and then transmitted back to some of those farm workers. But Nature this week publishes what looks like the first effort to get a much broader idea of the scale of the risk from fur farms, specifically in China. And unsurprisingly, there are a lot of worrying viruses out there. John Pettersson of Uppsala University was with the researchers in Fudan University as they collected, with some difficulty, and analysed the animal samples.
Basically, the farmers report that they have potentially a sick animal at the farm, and if they found them dead, they were sampled as soon as they were found dead. And that's been going on for years, basically, because it's a bit of a opportunistic sampling that obviously you can't know for sure when an animal will get sick or even if the animal will die.
But what sort of animals are you talking about here?
So these include those that are specifically bred for furs, to harvest their furs, like foxes and raccoon dogs. And you also have those that are bred not only for their furs, but also for food and medicinal purposes, like rabbits and roe deer.
So quite a collection. When you say sampling, could you be a bit more specific about the gruesome details?
Yes. So basically, the veterinarians will dissect the animals and collect lung tissues, intestines.
What, then these are sort of thumbnail-sized samples that were sent to the labs?
Exactly. So you take a small tissue sample that you process with various laboratory techniques to extract the genetic material, and in this case, the RNA that we subsequently will sequence to identify any viruses that might be in there.
And I think this is quite an interesting point, that it's partly because the technology is so good now, you don't need the whole virus, and presumably the samples are sort of sterilized pretty early on in the process. But just by looking at all the RNA in these samples, you can see what belongs to the dogs or the roe deer, but you can also identify all the bacteria and viruses.
Exactly. You get a mixture of what's the RNA that belongs to the host animal, and a small proportion will be those of microbes, like viruses and bacteria.
Looking at the paper, you've got a large number of animal species involved, a huge number of different viruses that you pulled out. But give me a sense of the kind of associations that you found that worried you.
When you start to look, you tend to find that there's a huge uncovered diversity. And in this case, you have it in animals that are perhaps not that commonly sequenced compared to like pigs or chickens and such animals. So it's worrisome that you find that these animals tend to share a lot of viruses. So between different species and even between different taxonomic orders, if you sort of think of virus evolution from that perspective, it's really important that you have ample chance to infect various hosts. And what you can see now is that you have viruses that are shared among so many different species.
I mean, you're talking about things like coronaviruses, are you, which we've sort of learnt move very easily between species, and that's the kind of thing.
Exactly. So there were heaps of different coronaviruses, so not just those that are found within the sort of SARS-CoV-2 family that people are know about now, but also other types that really, so I think we found seven different species of coronaviruses. If you sort of think of all the viruses found, the really interesting thing was that we expanded the host range for many of these viruses quite significantly. So out of the 125 viruses found, over 60% were identified in new hosts compared to where they've previously been found. So the more you look, the more you tend to find. And to me, that's really interesting.
And you say that's interesting because it sort of demonstrates how adaptable these viruses are moving from species to species?
Exactly. In some sense, viruses can be really host-specific, that you find them only in certain species. But for like the two that are highlighted here, like coronaviruses and influenza viruses, you tend to see that they really do jump between different species. If you couple this to that all animals were found deceased, it makes you wonder how many of these are like actually pathogenic. Were they sort of the sole cause of the disease, or are there other reasons for the animals dying?
Right. I mean, that seems to me sort of quite important. I don't know if there's any way that you can work that bit out, but you know, they could just be carrying these viruses, but something completely different was the cause of their death.
It's possible, of course. You can't know entirely for certain until you do like cell culture experiments and exposure experiments and so on. But some of these do give a good indication. For example, there was a bat-related coronaviruses found in two minks that showed severe respiratory syndrome. And sometimes there's a good indication that some viruses might be the causative agent of a disease. But in the end, it's difficult to say for certain, of course.
I mean, it's another thing to say that they might be a threat to us humans. And we've seen with SARS-CoV-2 how much its infectivity and its virulence has changed in just a few years. Little details of mutations make a big difference. Is there any way you can tell whether any of these viruses might be a threat to humans?
We try to indicate to call them so-called high-risk viruses in the paper. So some of these are known zoonotic viruses that you've already found in humans, but there's quite a few that were sort of indicated to be high-risk viruses just because they were found in dead animals. We could see that they were found in two or more different taxonomic orders. So there are definitely viruses there that requires further attention.
The one other thing which struck me reading this, I can understand that we still generally need meat. I know there are people who disagree, but there are good human reasons for breeding animals for meat, for sustenance, for nutrition. For fur, you know, our ancestors, sure, they didn't have a choice, but these days we can clothe ourselves without ever going near an animal.
I, well, personally see no reason to wear anything like a fur coat or a leather jacket as such, but it's also difficult to tell people that what they should do, actually. But if there's a demand for fur and leather and meat products and so on, you have to realize also that it will have consequences, in a sense that bigger fur farms, bigger meat farms and whatnot will continue to run the risk of spreading viruses to humans and other animals, for that matter.
Virologist John Pettersen. Of course, this kind of knowledge is not much use unless it's shared widely. We learned early on in the pandemic how important the genetic details of SARS-CoV-2 were in tracking the spread of the virus and spotting new variants. Indeed, the vaccines were designed within hours from gene sequences that had been shared electronically long before any biological samples became available. But scientists also learned during the pandemic that databases designed for a simpler world simply weren't up to the pace and needs of the health crisis. Emma Hodcroft is a virologist based in Switzerland. We first interviewed her about those COVID-infected mink in 2020. And from the database she'd put together in a hurry, Next Strain, she was able to reassure us then that those new SARS-2 mutants weren't a great threat. But with lessons from the pandemic, she's teamed up with researchers around the world to develop a new virus database, PathoPlexus, to speed up the sharing of gene sequences.
For the average person, it may not be obvious why how scientists are storing data has much of a direct impact on their lives. But in the pandemic, I think a lot of people will remember how much virus sequences, so looking at the RNA, the genetic material of the viruses, was actually pretty much part of our day-to-day life. We were hearing updates all the time about what variant might have been detected, whether a mutation has appeared, what impact that might have on immunity or the vaccines. And all of this information was coming from having those sequences being sampled in individuals, sequenced, and then shared by scientists so that we were getting this global picture of what SARS-CoV-2 was doing so that we could keep an eye out for things that might change, have an idea for what that means for the future, whether we might have another wave, etc.
It's a sort of form of librarianship of incredibly important details.
It really is, because the only way that scientists can do this, if they're restricted to only looking at the sequences they can gather, that might just be from their city. And so how scientists share that data is really, really important to getting a big picture view of the pathogens that are troubling us globally.
The other thing which I do recall from the pandemic was that we learned, it all seemed to work very well, but we learned over time that actually it was a bit of a, I don't know, cardboard and sticking tape operation, that there's actually, it's not as official, as it were, the way these data are shared.
Yeah, I think people might assume that there is an international body that regulates how these kinds of sequences should be shared, maybe the WHO. But actually, it is, I wouldn't necessarily say sticking tape and cardboard, but it's much more of a kind of scientist-driven effort. And there are some initiatives that have been around for a long time and that scientists have been using for a long time. But there also were developed when sequencing was a lot more expensive than it was today, and when we weren't doing as much as we are today. So I think it's also worth considering, you know, as we look into a future where we're probably going to be sequencing a lot more viruses and a lot more pathogens, how can we make sure that we do have a good place for scientists around the world where they feel comfortable sharing data?
I mean, I do recall some people getting locked out of one of the critical databases because they were accused of misusing data, they disagreed, blah, blah, blah. So, and it was that kind of transparency thing, I think, that's worrying you.
I think there is a very real concern for submitters about people using data inappropriately. You know, that is one of the things that stops people from sharing data, is that they're worried that they will share the data and someone else will get a publication on it, or that data might be used to develop a vaccine that then isn't available in their country. So I think having some kind of being answerable to the community is really important to build trust. But at the same time, it's also really important that the community understands how you're making those decisions and feels involved in that process as well.
I guess it's an interesting thing. You're on the interface, as it were, between pure science, where you might find the gene for something and that's the next Nobel Prize. Or on the other hand, you're seeing that something is going on in some city, that there's a new mutation that we need a vaccine against.
Yes, and I think a lot of the sequence sharing, the focus in recent years is on the public health part. But it has to be considered a balance, because in science, we do have sometimes somewhat conflicting rewards. You know, scientists are measured by how many papers we publish and, you know, how many Nobel awards we might win. But that can sometimes be at odds in our reward system about how should we really be using this data? How do we make sure that it's appropriately attributed, that the people that generated it are the ones publishing those papers or getting those awards, if it's appropriate? And so things like PathoPlexus, I really hope, can help to protect the people uploading data so that it can share that data. It can be used for the good part, for the observation, for looking for mutations, for understanding the diseases, without people feeling like they give up their right to publish the paper or go in for that award.
So what makes PathoPlexus different from earlier initiatives?
One of the main things with PathoPlexus is that we offer two options for how you can share data. So you can share your data completely openly straight away. And this is important because some scientists are really happy to share their data straight away and have other people use it without any restriction.
So I find a SARS-CoV-2 variant and I can put the data up there and anybody could use it any way they like.
Exactly, exactly. And the interface with PathoPlexis makes that really easy. So easier than some people have found previous databases to upload that data. On the other hand, though, if you want to share data quickly, maybe there's an outbreak in your area, so you really want to let all scientists know what's happening, but you also want to reserve the right that you want to be the one to publish the big analysis of this sequence, you can also opt to keep your data restricted on PathoPlexis for up to 1 year. So during that 1 year, other people can use it for kind of public health uses, for example, making a report to their government or tweeting about it on Twitter to help raise awareness, talking about it in the news, but they can't publish on that sequence without your permission for up to 1 year.
I mean, it's interesting you felt the need to sort of invent a new database to do this rather than to sort of modify existing ones.
I think mostly it's because the databases that exist at the moment really go all one way or all the other.
I suppose the real test of this is, do you think something like PathoPlexis at least would put us in a better position if another pandemic is knocking at our door in terms of getting the absolutely key biological data out?
I really hope so. One way that we are preparing for that at PathoPlexis is that we can actually add a new virus very quickly if there's an emergency situation. Unlike other databases, we don't have to put a lot of kind of quality checks and controls in place in order to add a new virus. And so in theory, we could start accepting completely novel virus sequences within about 24 hours. And we hope that could help to ensure that data sharing is at the start of a pandemic, which was critical for SARS-CoV-2. And then later down the line, we hope that by submitters feeling really protected by PathoPlexis and supported and having a really user-friendly interface and computer-friendly interface, they'll continue to share data with PathoPlexis.
Emma Hodcroft, in an ideal world, that might be the last we hear on this programme, at least, of PathoPlexis. But viruses do keep emerging and do keep spreading.
That justice system ultimately ignored all of those bodies and all of the families.
The stories they don't want told.
I was one of many people that were victims who was used.
Being lied to, tricked, and traded like a commodity.
Holding the powerful to account.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And the growing threat of Mpox, particularly in the Democratic Republic of Congo, is a worrying example. A smallpox vaccine called MVA or Jynneos gives some protection against Mpox. But there's good news this week in an experimental vaccine developed especially for Mpox by Moderna, one of the companies that brought us the mRNA vaccines against COVID. Animal tests show that it appears to be highly effective. Galit Alter, Vice President of Immunology Research at Moderna, told me the approach is very much like their COVID vaccine.
So we are a platform company, and that means that we have over 12 years of history in developing very safe and highly immunogenic lipid nanoparticles that can deliver mRNA to the immune system to train the system to fight against different infectious diseases. So utilizing that platform technology, we're able now to take on new pathogens or new threats by simply designing antigens of interest to express off of mRNA and to essentially expose the immune system to high-quality targets on these next-generation pathogens of interest to train the immune system. So really, it's 12 years of capability that we're deploying now for monkeypox to be able to rapidly respond to this ongoing threat.
I mean, I'm quite curious, what's the turnaround time from sort of deciding you're going to do something to have something you could at least test in the lab?
COVID-19, I think, probably was the best record where we saw within 11 months from sequence to vial, really end clinical trial, emergency use authorization. The timeline for essentially making the vaccine itself really is only a couple months. But then the clinical trials is really what most likely is going to dictate really how quickly it's going to enter into populations to help to curb disease or pandemics.
What you're reporting at the moment is testing it in some kind of non-human primate. How does it look? I suppose it's a very basic question.
Yeah, so we had done a study in mice previously where we were able to test the immunogenicity and the quality of the protection against another pox viral ortholog, so a virus called vaccinia. And now we moved it into non-human primates, which is really the most faithful recapitulation of the human disease manifested following monkeypox infection. And we were just elated to see the quality of the immune responses that were induced by mRNA. All animals survived an incredibly lethal challenge of the monkeypox virus. And also, we saw that these vaccine-induced immune responses were able to attenuate the pathogenesis of the infection. So we saw fewer lesions for much shorter periods of time, less viral replication, both in the blood as well as in the throat, really showing us that the vaccine is able to curb the disease associated with monkeypox, but also potentially induce protection against future transmission by just lowering the ability of the virus to replicate.
That's incredibly important. You compared this against the thing that they're using with the World Health Organization at the moment and with just saline, I think, just to make sure that, you know, you got a good comparison.
Absolutely. So we did compare it to a Jynneos-like vaccine, which is an MVA-based vaccine. Both vaccines, the mRNA and MVA, induce 100% survival in non-human primates compared to the saline control group. And that is the most important data that we found in this paper, and that is that both of these vaccines are incredibly effective at preventing disease and death in these animal models.
And there are two strains around at the moment. There's a strain one, which is, I think, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Central Africa, and the other, the strain two, is in Western Africa. Which one are you looking at? And do you know if this is going to be protective against both?
Yeah, so this was a clade 1B challenge, which is the current circulating strain. What is important is that we have seen that this vaccine induces immune responses, very potent immune responses, both against the clade 2B and the clade 1B. And what is important about those immune responses is really the reason we're seeing this conservation of immunity across the different subfamilies of monkeypox is because we selected four antigens from the virus that are highly conserved. We were able to really identify these four antigens as the immunodominant targets for protective antibody responses that are highly conserved, but not only against the 1B and the 2B clades for monkeypox, but also across many other orthopox viruses, so other pox viral relatives.
So this is a very key part then of the virus, which is, when you say the antigen, this is a bit that's prompting the immune response.
Right. These are the proteins on the surface of the virus that are required for infection. So if we make antibodies to these targets, we can essentially block those viruses from causing the infection or disease, and as well as clear any infected cells as rapidly as possible.
I guess things are all pretty urgent at the moment. What's the status of trying the vaccine in people?
So we are in the process of conducting a phase 1-2 trial in the UK. And so we're waiting to see how we perform from an immunogenicity and safety perspective. And so we are quite optimistic. The urgency right now at a global level really, I think, is focused on deploying vaccines as rapidly as possible, those that are approved, to the places in the world where the virus is causing the outbreak. And so I think what is important to stress is that the MVA-based vaccines, the Jynneos vaccine, does provide 100% protection in our non-human primate model against death.
Any plans to test it in Africa, in the Democratic Republic of Congo or anywhere?
We hope for the future, but right now we're focused on today's concern, which is really trying to understand how our platform is able to drive immune responses in these very challenging conservative animal models, and then to try to understand how we can contribute to the overall global effort to make sure the vaccines are getting as quickly as possible to those that need it most around the world.
And you can make large numbers of doses like you did with the COVID vaccines.
Theoretically, that is possible. That is not our current mandate today.
I mean, I'm wondering also about the, it's not necessarily your responsibility, but the, obviously the burden at the moment is in Africa, in Democratic Republic of Congo and so on. Who's going to pay for this? Because they are quite expensive. Are you in talks with the WHO or anyone?
Yeah, so I think for today's conversation, I think we're talking about this study that was published in this manuscript focused on trying to understand the immunological basis of protection induced by mRNA vaccines against the monkeypox virus. I think that, you know, the question about who's going to pay for the doses that are going to Africa right now, which are largely MVA-based vaccines, I think that is an important political discussion that is ongoing with, you know, countries from all across the world.
Galit Alter, who told me not to expect results from the human trials before the start of next year. And if you're interested, there's more on access to Mpox treatments on Health Check with Claudia Hammond this week, like Science in Action. You can download that from bbcworldservice.com or from your usual podcast provider. Learning is lifelong and actually starts in some cases pre-life. As fetuses, we humans learn the sound of our mother's voice, somewhat muffled, from within the womb. We can even become prenatally familiar with the theme tunes of popular TV shows. And this week, I learned that chicks can listen into the outer world from inside their egg. At least in the case of yellow-legged gulls, who turn out to be way more interesting than I'd anticipated. I learned that listening to Francisco Ruiz Wire.
Gulls, they really have a really interesting, intense social life. An important aspect of gull life is that they engage in a number of elegant and complex social behavior, including territorial behaviors or food solicitation in chicks, also vocalization between breeding partners to coordinate the parental care.
So this goes beyond courtship. This is actually, even after they've laid the eggs, after the chicks have hatched, they're talking to each other.
Yeah, they are really talking to each other, and this communication can persist through incubation. Gulls often communicate with their mates during the breeding season. For example, they have sounds and displays as part of a conversation between pair members over where to nest, for example. And also, nest relief displays during incubation may act as a means of communication about foraging opportunities, also contribute to equal division of parental care. Indeed, we know that gull communicative pairs can coordinate incubation tasks and foraging patterns better, probably providing more care to eggs and chicks.
I had no idea. I mean, in the paper you talk about some of the pairs being chatty and some of them being more quiet. You've recorded all that, have you?
Yeah, so we started by recording our gull pairs to know what levels of parental communication they had. Actually, we found that there is variation in the levels of parent-parent communication among gull pairs.
Now, this is where it gets into slightly more familiar territory. But you say that the gull chicks, while they're still embryos inside the egg, they can actually hear the sound at some point before they're hatched.
Yeah. We know for our research and also research from other research labs that bare embryos have the potential to perceive and respond to sounds outside the egg.
In your experiment, you start effectively swapping around the chick eggs, or you're raising them in incubators away from the actual birds to see if you can manipulate what they're hearing and how they behave later.
In our experiment, we basically studied 44 gull families on the Salvora Island in Spain. And then from each nest, we took two sibling eggs and we exposed them to different noises in artificial incubators so that half the eggs listened to audio playbacks of chatty, communicative parents, while their siblings were exposed to the sound of quiet or less communicative parents. And then just after hatching, both siblings were placed into a gull foster family to be raised together.
So they were returned to the colonies, but not necessarily to the original parent birds.
This is a really important part of our experiment. So they were placed into foster family, but never their original family.
That's so interesting. And what you wanted to see was whether they behaved differently according to the sounds they had heard in the egg.
Exactly. Our intention was that the only difference between siblings were this specific temporal window during prenatal development, just a week of sound exposure. So they had similar genetic background, and after hatching, they were raised in the same familiar context. So the only difference between siblings was that specific developmental window.
And the idea was to see if the chicks, when they hatched, were different in any way. Did you see any differences?
We found that prenatal sound has long-lasting physiological and behavioral effects. So, for example, we found that eggs exposed to chatty parents took longer to hatch, and also there were changes in the developmental mechanism between siblings. More specifically, we found an increase in hormonal stress response and DNA methylation, which is a biological change that can affect gene expression in chicks that prenatally exposed to quiet parents.
So their biology was actually changed, you're saying?
Exactly. And the mechanism involved in the control of their development.
Just explain this. Methylation, this is the alterations effectively to the way that the DNA works, but you mentioned also stress hormones?
Stress, exactly, yeah. We found that chicks that were prenatally exposed to quiet parents, they showed an increase in hormonal stress response, which is the physiological response to a stressful situation.
That's really interesting. In other words, you're saying that in the egg, if I can put it this way, hearing the parental birds talking to each other made them calmer.
Well, actually, in our study, the result was that when they are exposed to quiet parents, then after hatching, the hormonal response to a stressful situation is higher. Instead, if they are exposed to communicative parents, which are supposed to be coordinated parents in girls, their stress response is lower in those chicks.
And also, I think you mentioned that they go through actions to get fed by the parents.
Absolutely. So when they hatch, we monitor the chick's growth and nutrition status until fledging to see how well they perform with their families. And we found that chicks prenatally exposed to chatty parents showed more begging behavior, more solicitation behavior. So we found that the chicks grow better than those exposed to quiet parents, probably because they are being feeding better by their parents.
Ecologist Francisco Ruiz-Raya, who's just moved from the University of Vigo in Spain to Glasgow University in the UK. His results are published in Science Advances, where you can also see some short clips of the gulls sharing their caring duties. I find it all quite charming. Producer Jonathan Blackwell and I, Ronan Pease, we're off to hatch some news stories for next week's Science in Action from the BBC World Service. I do hope you'll join us.
That justice system ultimately ignored all of those bodies and all of the families.
The stories they don't want told.
I was one of many people that were victims who was used.
Being lied to, tricked, and traded like a commodity.
Holding the powerful to account.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.